And so here he is. We're really pleased that he's here this year, and he's giving a talk, Shouting Out Beauty, the Wisdom of Nature. So tuning in with our truth and beauty theme this year. And I would like to rejoice in a couple of things, Loka Bandhu. I didn't have to think hard about this at all. There's just a couple of images from over the years of Loka Bandhu around Butterfield. Loka Bandhu is amazing in all sorts of ways. He's got incredible confidence to just sort of do things and get things on, you know, and go into the solstice festival at Stonehenge with a massive Buddhist rupa and meditate in the midst of the chaos and things like that, which I would find terrifying personally. One of the memories from my first year at Butterfield, as part of the festival organisers, was Loka Bandhu waking up in his, what do you call those things? It's like a cross between a sleeping bag and a tent. Bivouac, yeah, in his bivy bag, at about sort of 5:30 or something, and just whacking off a few emails and sorting out a little bit of admin, sort of under the trees, you know. So there's something about sort of spanning these different worlds, you know, sort of the world in which we stay in contact with people all over the planet, and the world where you're just sleeping out under the trees with the rain coming down. And Loka Bandhu seems to sort of move between these worlds very easily and very comfortably, and I really enjoy that, appreciate that quality. The other image that comes to mind from the same year, that was the year when we had 2 days to set up the Butterfield Festival, as opposed to 2 weeks, which we've just had. And I remember Loka Bandhu sitting in the tea tent on our little setup thing amidst utter chaos and panic and rising anxiety about, you know, whether we were going to have any toilets or, you know, whatever, basic things. And Loka Bandhu was sitting there writing the program, which is, if you've ever done a sort of programming timetabling thing, it requires incredible degree of concentration and attention. And he was just sat there. He didn't even have his own tent. He was just sort of in the, you know, in the communal space, getting on with it, quite happy with all this chaos going on around. And I think that really, that is something about the essence of Loka Bandhu and what he brings, a sort of quiet, grounded, centered confidence, and confidence in the Dharma, and bringing that into, you know, this sort of space. So, I've said enough. I'd like to hand over to Loka Bandhu.
I'll just arrange myself. So, is that working?
No.
Is that right? Yeah? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So, yeah. Thank you, Akashati. I should mention, Akashati will be giving the second talk in this Dharma marquee in 2:00. And she is just as good a person as me to give a talk. And I was meant to be introducing her, but I double booked myself, so I can't. So, but I'm sad about that, because I would have loved to introduce Akashati to you today. I was writing my final notes for this talk, and about an hour ago, and it was pouring with rain. I'm sure you were out there somewhere, pouring with rain. And I was reflecting, here we are, here's me trying to summon up thoughts about the beauty of nature, and here's nature pouring on us. In the middle of an English summer, middle of July, meant to be a festival. But you will notice it is not raining. And there's, you know, there's a kind of teaching there that it was and now it's not, and we have survived and here we are. So, I'll start off, I think, with a bit of a confession. Because I found this talk very difficult to write. And if you know, you know, you get invited to give a talk a month in advance by some well-organized organizer, and you just kind of say yes, because you do, and they say, give us a title, so you come up with a title, and then you forget all about it. At least in my case, I forgot all about it. Came back to it about a week ago, and I've been really trying to connect with this theme ever since. It's been quite a journey of kind of investigation for me. What is... you know, what is our relationship with nature? What is beauty? What can we learn? You know, how can a Buddhist practice in the middle of nature? So quite an exploration, and not at all a finished product. So hopefully there's plenty of time after this for some kind of questions, answers, discussion, you know, continued exploration. Yeah. I'll just say a word or so about the title, Shouting Out Beauty. It comes from one of the very first Buddhist books I ever read, sometime back in the 70s. I was just kind of becoming a Buddhist. And certainly for me, maybe for you, you know, that your early kind of impressions with something like Buddhism are very formative. They kind of stay with you. And I read three books way back then in the 70s. One was called The Goose in the Bottle. It was something about, it was a Zen text, and it was all about, there was a bottle, and this goose had got inside it, and how did the goose go in the bottle, and how was the goose going to get out of the bottle? And I never had a clue what it was all about. I still don't. That was the first one. The second one was called The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment. That was fairly attractive to me for obvious reasons. But I still can't remember what it said. Something about it was, you know, you are enlightened already and just kind of stop trying and wake up or something. And then the third one, maybe you've heard all you need to hear. You can feel free to leave anytime. The third one was called The Gospel According to Zen. A little kind of scruffy 1970s paperback, but in it was mostly consisted of parallel sayings of Jesus and Zen and how they were all part of one thing. But in the middle of it was this wonderful text, which I've treasured ever since, called the Zen Rin. The Zen Rin. And it was just 30 or 40 or 50 verses, but each of which was really beautiful. So the kind of inspiration of this talk comes from that, and I'll quote, you know, bits and pieces as we go along. And I made some bit of research about 15 years later into what the Zen Rin was. It was quite hard to discover. But I discovered there was a collection called the Zen Rin of about 5,000 verses from the Japanese Zen tradition. And each one of them was a subject for meditation. You could just take any of these verses and just really dwell in it, you know, and go deeper and deeper and deeper. And, you know, that will be a kind of door to awakening for you. So the Zen Rin, somebody had taken out about 50 of them and put them in the Gospel According to Zen. Yeah. Lastly, just to say, I think I chose this subject just because nature is very dear to my heart. I love nature more and more. I love being in nature, practicing in nature, kind of, you know, learning from nature. I think what I found difficult is, what is beauty? Beauty is a bit more mysterious, but I'll come on to that. So what I want to do is take one approach to the Buddhist path. There's all kinds of ways you can talk about Buddhism. This is just one. But it's based on the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, very classic formulation. And if you take that approach, you can kind of divide it into two. So first off is what you might call the path of vision, the path of vision. And secondly is the path of transformation. So the Eightfold Path of the Buddha kind of turns into two paths, the path of vision and the path of transformation. And that happens to be the title of one of the books we publish, it might even be for sale outside, called Vision and Transformation. But then the question arises, where does your vision, your kind of vision, come from, and how do you go about transformation? So I'm going to kind of explore both of those with regard to nature. But I want to kind of end up with more of a kind of questioning approach about what might be the strengths and weaknesses of this. And also, how might we, as 21st century Western Buddhists, take up these very traditional teachings and kind of use them, you know, in this very different modern world. But also, might there be any kind of I don't want to say weaknesses or gaps, but anything we need to kind of even add to these very traditional teachings in our very different Western modern world. So that's the kind of very open, exploratory part of the talk. So, the path of vision, eh? And I think, yeah, the first thing to say is that no religion and no kind of priest or no institutional structure has any kind of monopoly on vision. Anybody can have this kind of vision or insight or just heart-opening experience any time. I think plenty of religions or priesthoods try and kind of capture it. You know, they have the knowledge. You need the book. It's all handed down. I don't think Buddhism's immune to that, actually, but I strongly believe nobody, or no one, or no tradition, has any monopoly on vision. And I would guess, with confidence, that all of us, you know, have had our moments of vision, because they can come at any time, in any way. And they're just something that kind of opens our heart to, you know, what we could become. Or they kind of open our eyes with a kind of fresh clarity to what we want to, you know, change, what we want to leave behind, what we want to move away from. So vision kind of comes in two ways. One is looking forwards to a kind of bigger, wider, freer future. But also one is looking at our present, you know, limitations or stuckness or unsatisfactoriness and wanting to kind of move away from that. But either way, vision is what gives us that kind of glimpse. Things could be different, things could be, should be different. We want to be different. Generally, I think it comes in a kind of flash or flashes, whatever. And it may come and go. It may be a real struggle to keep hold of our vision. But we need to, because what comes next is a much longer, slower, you know, less kind of glamorous process of transformation. As we take the whole of us, with all our habits and patterns and views, and try and change. And not only the whole of us, the whole of our environment, you know, because that contributes to who we are and the world we live in, and change that too. So the path of vision can come at any time. The path of transformation is kind of ongoing. But nature, I think, can be, and I'm sure is, a wonderful source of vision. You just need to kind of go outside and open your eyes. There it is. I think in principle, you can open your eyes in any situation at any time, and there it is. You can open up your eyes in this rather strange green and red kind of battered old marquee, and there it is, you know. But opening your eyes in the middle of nature is kind of just much easier. Nature is a teacher. Yeah. Along the way, I'll just drop in verses, almost at random, I think, from the Zenrin, because that's this text that's inspired me. So here's one. So don't try and understand it, just kind of listen to it, let the images, let the words speak to you. I should mention, I have no idea who wrote the Zenrin. I'm not sure anybody wrote it. It's just it's the accumulated wisdom of the whole tradition, kind of written down. So hey, mountains and rivers, the whole earth, all manifest forth the essence of being. So you can imagine taking that into your meditation, you know, maybe day after day. Mountains and rivers, the whole earth, all manifest forth the essence of being. Or another one. Taking up one blade of grass, use it as a 16-foot golden Buddha. It's just as kind of, you know, just as kind of great a teacher as a 16-foot golden Buddha. Well, here's another one, actually. Nothing whatever is hidden. From of old, all is clear as daylight. I love that one. That's the opening verse. Nothing whatever is hidden. Or from of old, all is clear as daylight. And actually, to have that kind of vision, all you need to do is open your eyes, you know, with a kind of fresh, pure awareness, and there you go. Nothing whatever is hidden. So that kind of leads on in a minute to the path of transformation, because opening your eyes with this fresh, pure awareness is maybe not so easy. But just another minute or two on vision. So just imagine really looking at nature. I mean, what might you see? And I think the first thing for many of us is just beauty. Beauty. Nature is so beautiful. And for me personally, the more I go on, the more I find my beauty in nature rather than anything else. And our modern society is all about selling us stuff. And a lot of the stuff is either meant to be useful or beautiful. But I find nature incomparably more beautiful than stuff. I really do. And sometimes after you've been in a field for a week or so, you go back home or back into the modern world, and you go to kind of normal places, you go in a supermarket, and it just feels completely weird. I mean, a supermarket is extraordinary. It's just bizarre compared to being in a field, you know, full of trees and grass, maybe some mud, whatever. But that's beautiful for me in a way that supermarkets, for instance, are not. Anyway, imagine looking with this fresh, pure awareness at nature. You see beauty. But you'd very quickly see something else. You just see change. In nature, there is change. There's constant change. And behind, I mean, one of the great truths of Buddhism is impermanence. Everything is impermanent. That's a real wisdom teaching. We don't kind of live our lives like that. We live our lives like things are kind of fixed and we can arrange them around us in the way that we like, and there you go, we'll be happy. But actually, in nature, everything constantly changes. Everything is impermanent. And you don't need to open your eyes very far to see that in nature. Another thing you see in nature, another kind of vision, is that how can I put it? Things happen in nature because of, you know, particular causes. Things arise in dependence and conditions. We don't live in a kind of random universe. We live in a universe where everything changes, but because it's part of a network of a million complex conditions and causes that bring that new thing about. So a blade of grass grows, not at random, but because of the soil and the sun and the water and whatever else. And that's all part of the kind of necessary conditions for that little blade of grass. And the more you look into nature, the more you see the kind of laws of conditionality that cause things to be the way they are. And the more you look at them and the more you understand them, in a sense, the wiser you become. Buddhism has this wonderful word of skill. You become skilled in just knowing the conditions, you know, that cause things to come into being. If you're a gardener, you kind of know what you need to grow your vegetables. If you're a Buddhist, you kind of learn to know what you need to grow wisdom and compassion and joy and freedom. Yeah? So that nothing's random there, but you need to kind of become skilled. And looking at nature, you just see it in operation, minute by minute by minute. Yeah, and connected with that is the truth of interconnectedness. In nature, nothing is separate. I mean, nothing is separate. That blade of grass is totally connected to everything around it. And that's part of one vast web of interconnectedness. So we, very commonly, are just locked into a kind of view that we are separate. You know, this is me and over here, and that is you over there. And if I get what I want arranged around me, I will be happy. And if I stop you getting it yourselves, you know, I'll be all the happier. But, you know, it's just not how it is. In nature, everything is interconnected. Everything is interdependent. And that's a truth that applies to us just as much as a blade of grass. So you can just start to see it in nature, and then slowly, slowly, maybe, apply it to yourself. Yay. So, just the last thing to say on vision is I just believe that once you kind of begin to see the way things are, changing is so much easier and so much more organic. If you kind of see that things are interconnected and you're not separate, you just naturally want to live your life that way. it just becomes futile to live your life like I am separate from you, which is your instinct if you don't see it. So vision kind of leads naturally to transformation, although transformation takes work as well. Is that just another verse, maybe, from the Zenrin? I've said already, nothing whatever is hidden. From of old, all is clear as daylight. But here's one, the next one. The old pine tree speaks divine wisdom. The secret bird manifests eternal truth. The old pine tree speaks eternal wisdom. The secret bird manifests eternal truth. And for me, that's something about, you know, there they both are, the pine tree and the bird. But when you look at them, they just require everything else to sustain them. The bird in the sky just needs the air, you know, for one thing, to sustain it. So, I want to move on. And in my mind, at least, it kind of gets more and more interesting the more and more you get into transformation, and then also the more and more you start asking questions about what we need, what we can take from these teachings. So transformation. I'll start off with the first one for me. I started coming to Buddhafield retreats, and we kind of had this bright idea, let's do a retreat in a field. And we kind of got ourselves there. And then the time for the public arriving grew near. And as the time for the public arriving grew near, a cloud in the sky also drew near. And I suddenly was filled with this awful anxiety that it was going to rain. Here we were, we had this wonderful plan, but it was going to rain. And I think it did, actually, rain. It was probably July, again, in the middle of an English summer, again, and probably raining, again. So, hey. But what happened next? It stopped raining. And I kind of learned, almost in that moment, that in nature, things come and go. But hey, it rains, you get wet. So what? It stops raining, you get dry. And that whole kind of pattern of anxiety, or feeling responsible, or, you know, maybe people won't like it if they get wet, kind of came up really strongly for me in one of our first retreats. And then passed. It's a bit like the worst happened, and we survived. I discovered, you know, I'm waterproof. So are they. And since then, I've been on plenty of retreats and festivals in the middle of an English summer, and guess what? It has poured with rain. So, since then, I think I found nature, and just being in nature, and nature happening and coming and going, just a real antidote to anxiety. It kind of doesn't matter. Life goes on. And it really does. Life goes on, whatever happens. Yeah. The second thing for me, and this has just grown slowly more and more and more over many, many years, is beauty, nature and beauty. And I've got some questions about this that I'll come back to later. But more and more, I've said already, I find my beauty in nature rather than anywhere else. I don't need to spend money to kind of have the, you know, the beauty to have beauty in my life. And I find the beauty in the most simple things in nature. Just a blade of grass, just a little pile of leaves on the ground, whatever. It's so beautiful. It's just exquisite. And in that beauty is the whole teaching about simplicity. Nature is so simple. You don't need anything to have beauty there to be happy. And I remember another retreat, I think it was, and I spent half my retreat craving the end of the retreat. I'm sure if you've been on retreats, you probably had the same. Craving the end of the retreat. And specifically, what I was craving at the end of my retreat was cheesecake. I wanted cheesecake. I could picture it in my meditations. I could more or less taste it in my mouth. So, the retreat finished. Guess what I did? I shot down to the supermarket, got my cheesecake, and ate it. But then what happened? There's a moment of kind of so what? I mean, so what? You get your cheesecake, and it is, you know, it's kind of crumbly and biscuity and sugary and, you know, lovely. But kind of, it's not happiness. It, you know, I mean, so what? I had my cheesecake. And I realised to get my cheesecake, I had to enter this whole world of supermarkets and bright lights and weirdness. And slowly, it has been slow, I've just been content to kind of be in the beauty of nature with, you know, twigs on the ground and leaves and blades of grass and not need quite so much cheesecake, etc. Yeah. So I find beauty quite indefinable. I couldn't define it. But, you know, it's there. We kind of know it. And it is beautiful and it's incredibly nourishing, beauty. So the third thing, these are all kind of, for me, these are all part of transformation. To transform your anxiety is a real transformation. To transform, you know, what you crave and what you're contented with is a real transformation. The third thing is just perspective. If you're in nature, it gives you a bigger and bigger perspective, I think. And one thing you see in nature is the whole process of birth and death. In nature, things are born, and they live, and they die. Well, kind of often much, much quicker than us, but sometimes much, much slower than us. But you just see it going on around you. And then you see it going on around you, you get used to it, and you begin to apply it to yourself. I mean, here we are. We have been born, we are living, we will die. There's nothing much you can do about it. But you can kind of be aware of it with fear, or just with peace. I don't know how I will be when I get to that moment of truth and I start, you know, actually dying, but I hope, you know, something about my a kind of interconnectedness with nature will stand me in good stead. So nature kind of opens your perspective. This is life. This is what happens. Things are born, things live, and things die. But also it opens your eyes to the fact, you know, we've got our concerns. We've got little things that are really important to us, to send that text message and collect that email and, you know, buy that cheesecake. But, you know, the life and the world and nature is so much bigger, much, 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 much bigger. And all the things we're caught up with, by comparison, they're mainly doing, but they're kind of small, really, in the bigger picture. They are kind of small. So setting up a festival like this is a good example, because there's a million things to do, and they kind of have to get done. But there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger, 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 bigger perspective. So here's another verse from the Zenrin. Another kind of subject for meditation, if you like. Sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes and the grass grows by itself. Hey, sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes and the grass grows by itself. And I don't think that is part of the lazy man's guide to enlightenment. It could be, but it's not saying, you know, just sunbathe all your life. It's kind of saying, you know, don't be too caught up with your little missions. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. Yeah. And something I've personally come to enjoy more and more is literally just sitting in the middle of nature and just looking around. It's not quite a meditation practice, but it's just being in nature, looking there. And last year I did a week's solitary retreat. Buddhists do retreats of all shapes and sizes. And one kind of retreat you can do is a solitary retreat, where you just go somewhere, where you will be alone for a week. And I went to Teepee Valley in Wales. Some of you might have heard of it. It's this community of teepee dwellers up in Wales. And I went there and just chose a piece of land where I knew nobody would come. And they didn't for a whole week. And it was high up and I could look down on the whole valley. And I found I wanted to just sit there hour after hour after hour just looking. And there was the clouds and the hills and the little teepees dotted about and curls of smoke. And the people were so small, they were tiny little dots. But I just looked and looked and looked at nature. It was wonderful. And I didn't kind of choose to do that, it's just what I wanted to do. But it was something about connecting myself more and more, just by looking. But not by doing. It wasn't a kind of, let's dig ditches and level terraces and build houses kind of connection. It was just a sitting. So another thing, another kind of path of transformation that's been important for me, is the whole practice of gratitude. gratitude. And I think the more you see your connections with nature, the more you realize your total dependence on nature. Total dependence. Supermarkets and stuff might make it look like you don't need nature. You just go shopping and you get all you need. But it doesn't take a lot of thought to realize that behind the supermarket, somewhere, you know, in some field, is, you know, the actual growth of the actual food. So we depend completely on Mother Nature. And one beautiful thing about festivals is we just come a little bit closer to that. There's the earth and the sky and, you know, the sun, even the rain. You know, we kind of need it all. And hopefully, without trying, without being lectured, that gives birth to gratitude. Just a kind of gratitude. The Buddhist word for gratitude, I could mention, is katanyuta. Katanyuta. Beautiful word. But what it translates as is the knowledge of benefits received. So you feel gratitude if you become aware, if you know that you have received a benefit from Mother Nature or whatever. The knowledge of benefits received. Yeah. But something else I found growing in me in the area of gratitude through my contact with nature, this is maybe a little bit paradoxical, is gratitude to human beings. So I genuinely feel a gratitude to nature, just for the complete sustenance of life. But I also feel a gratitude to my friends and to human society in general. Because nature is not all sweet and fluffy and nice. Nature, I've already said, is much, much bigger than we are. And in a way, nature doesn't care. I really think that. Nature does not care. Nature, it's a whole planet. It just goes on. And nature could kind of blow us over or blow us out or whatever without a second thought. You know, the planet would continue. So I also realize my dependence more and more on the kind of, you know, what we've created that allows human life to carry on, to sustain itself. Which means, my friends, which means human society. And I'll tell you where I came to see this most clearly, is we have a retreat center up in the mountains of Spain. Quite a kind of elemental environment. Way up, you know, above, not quite above the tree line, but pretty close to the sky. And we do our 4-month-long ordination retreats there. So I was there on my 4-month-long ordination retreat. And I went out for a walk one morning, and it was just beautiful, incredibly beautiful. You know, the sun and the trees and the rocks and the birdsong, just lovely. And I was kind of walking along with my heart open, feeling full of the beauty of nature. When I kind of realized that if I was just there, just me, it would be a very harsh environment. I mean, there's no water there to start with. No food there, for another thing. I would kind of perceive it in a very different way. I'd feel the sun kind of beating down on me. I'd feel the rocks kind of tearing my feet. I'd feel everything trying to take away, you know, the thorns and the gorse bushes, you know, stopping me eating them, even if you could. And that I was only there appreciating beauty because of what we'd created to kind of to live there. And I just, my heart, my kind of feeling of appreciation went out to the whole network that allowed us to be up there, walking in the hills in the dawn, but being fed and being watered. And that's an extreme example, because it's quite a harsh environment, but it's true of us here too. If we were just stuck in this field, we'd be eyeing up the cows, you know, what can we eat next? So that it takes a lot to sustain human life, and, you know, nature doesn't automatically provide it. Nature is, you know, following her own course. Yeah. So another thing, it's nature is. Sorry, I'm trying to think how to say this. Nature is. Can be a path of practice. I think through nature, you can just perceive the truth. And a lot of the Zenrin is about that. It's just about opening your eyes to the truth of things. There was a verse I already said, nothing whatever is hidden. From of old, all is clear as daylight. So, You can take nature as your path of practice, if you wish, and simply open your eyes to the truth of things as manifested in nature. And there's plenty of other Buddhist practices for doing that, and plenty of other practices in other spiritual traditions, but nature is the most accessible. I mean, there she is, at all times. I'll give you another verse from the Zenren. If you don't believe, look at September, look at October, the yellow leaves falling to fill both mountain and river. If you don't believe, look at September, look at October, the yellow leaves falling to fill both mountain and river. And that's something about just ongoing change and impermanence. Yeah. So one other thing, the last one in this, in six different ways we can transform ourselves to nature, is just the acquisition of skill. I think through nature, you start to see how things work. I've already mentioned this, but it can be a real path. Things arise not at random, but in dependence and conditions. To grow a blade of grass, you require so many things, the sun and the water and the soil, even the bacteria. And that's a path of learning. It's a path of awareness, but kind of a little bit more than awareness. It's a path of education. And you could simply look at the blade of grass and enjoy the beauty of it, but I think you can add to that by learning about it, learning what it really takes to grow a blade of grass. If anyone's grown vegetables, they'll know this even more. To grow a courgette, to grow a sunflower, you need a whole complex of good conditions. And that's a path not just of awareness, but of skill. And one thing that leads to is a wonderful kind of characteristic of the Buddha, which is, I mean, we'd probably call it low-impact living. The traditional Buddhist word is akirika, which means the trackless one, the one who leaves no track as he proceeds. So another little verse from the Zenren, it just says, entering the forest, he moves not the grass. Entering the water, he makes not a ripple. And I love that kind of quality of the Buddha, of living his life fully on the planet, but just not squashing things, not making a mess, not destroying life as he goes along. And I'll tell you another kind of learning experience for me, from the same retreat up in the Spanish mountains, was that we were there, and it was the end of the winter. It was quite tough. It was really cold. It was snow. And quite wild wind and everything. We were there for 4 months. So slowly, the winter ended and the spring came. And as the spring came, the flowers came. They were wonderful. The whole valley came to life. Incredibly beautiful. And I went for another walk up in the hills. And I was walking along, marveling at the beauty of nature. And I kind of stopped at a certain point, and I looked around, beautiful, and I looked at my feet, and the whole land, I'm not kidding, was a carpet of flowers, just a carpet of flowers. And I'd been stomping along, squishing these flowers as I'd gone, without kind of noticing. I'd just stomp, squish. And then I stopped and looked around and became aware. And I suddenly felt completely squashed, completely stuck. I couldn't move in any direction without squashing more flowers. And I didn't want to. But there I was, in the middle of this landscape full of flowers. And I was kind of shocked at myself. Just ignorance is bliss, kind of. But ignorance can be extremely clumsy. And you can squash a lot of flowers as you walk along not noticing them. And I think what I did is I kind of tried to backtrack as carefully as I could. At least I squashed the same flowers twice. I'm not quite sure if that's progress, but hey. For me, that was a definite growth in awareness, but quite a shocking one. Just to be so insensitive of what I was actually doing. So So I believe strongly in awareness, but I believe strongly in awareness kind of linked to knowledge. You've got to kind of learn about things as you become aware of them. Otherwise, you might perceive beauty, but you never learn how things work. And if you don't learn how things work, you don't really learn how to live in harmony with them. And if you don't learn to live in harmony with them, you can be incredibly clumsy, maybe not quite walking on flowers, but at least messing things up as you go along. So living outside for this week or so, as we're doing, is a wonderful lesson in just learning what it takes to live in harmony with nature. It's just a beginning, it's a lifetime's path, but it's a good beginning. So just a few more minutes, I want to talk about just some more kind of questions to raise as to how we might take these very traditional Buddhist teachings, whether from the Zenrin, the Japanese Buddhist tradition, or whether from the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, of vision and transformation, and kind of apply them to our situation today. Because the Buddha lived in such a different world to us, completely different world, 2,500 years ago in the middle of India, or the far eastern corner of India. And when he lived, I think it's true to say, civilization was little tiny pockets of civilization, villages, kind of hacked out of the jungle, little clearings in the jungle. And all around, the whole of India was covered in this vast jungle. An Indian jungle is real jungle. It kind of comes back and it kind of takes over if you leave it alone and, you know, don't watch it. And for them, I think, civilization was kind of fragile and kind of precious. You know, what they'd created, the kind of space they'd created in the jungle was precious. But for us, it's completely different. If there's any jungle left at all, that's what is little tiny pockets of jungle. We've kind of flattened the planet for our, quote, civilization. And what's fragile and at risk is what's left of, you know, the natural world, the jungle. So the Buddha didn't talk a great deal about the preservation of biodiversity or the, you know, the fragility of nature. Partly he didn't need to, and partly I just don't think he'd have seen it in the way that we can see it today. We can see very clearly today, nature is incredibly fragile, certainly the way we've left it at the moment. And we can see very clearly today just the kind of risk that, you know, the risks we run today in the world. Also, something different for the Buddha is he lived his life in a very localized way. The food would have been grown by that village. The rubbish would have been thrown away on the boundary of that village. The water would have come from the village. We live in an incredibly globalized world. I mean, Buddha Field, the cafe, makes a real effort to source local food, but in general, you look at your plate of muesli, it could come from all over the planet. It really could. The raisins from California, the oats from America, the hazelnuts from wherever the great hazelnuts, I don't know. We live in an incredibly globalized world. And the basic truths haven't changed one tiny bit. Things are interconnected, things arise in dependence and conditions, actions have consequences. But we need to kind of have quite a global perspective to see what the consequences of our actions could be. And I'll give you a little example. Imagine you go shopping and you want to buy an apple. So you go somewhere, doesn't matter if it's your supermarket or your friendly local greengrocers, and you'll have several different apples on the shelf. So if you just pick one, you're picking an apple with a whole chain of events behind it. So that apple could come from English apple orchards, if there's any left. There's some around Glastonbury, I know. Or it could come from New Zealand. That's where most of our apples seem to come from. Or it could come from Chile, or South Africa. And if you buy the one as opposed to the other, completely different consequences will ensue. If you buy your local Glastonbury apple, it's fairly kind of simple and straightforward. If you buy your New Zealand or South African or Chilean apple, it will have been flown over, quite likely. And the kind of consequences of flying it over are vastly different to the consequences of a local apple. Even the local apple these days could quite likely have got shipped to Scotland in order to put in, you know, boxes in order to ship back again. And all that is true, and those consequences are true, but you can't perceive them just by looking at the apple. You can perceive its colour and its weight and its texture, but you can't perceive the chain of events behind it just by looking at it. I think in the Buddha's day, you probably could have seen pretty much what that apple was part of. But these days you have to kind of learn about it. You've got to learn, this apple comes from Chile, the transportation involves flying involves whatever. So there's a kind of new dimension to add to the simple awareness of perception. There's the kind of awareness of education to add to that. If we want to become aware of the consequences of our actions. Something else which is quite a question for me is beauty. So I was out for a walk one day at one of our retreat centres, it's in East Anglia, and once again I was struck by the beauty of the scene. It was beautiful. There was a blue sky, green grass, brown earth of the field, and this wonderful yellow luminous grass kind of growing at the borders of the field. And the colours were so strong and clear and pure, it was magic. Could have been a painting by somebody. And I kind of looked at it and marvelled at it again, and then suddenly a kind of shock went through me. That's the only way I can describe it. And I kind of realised the grass, this luminous, beautiful yellow grass at the edge of the field, was bright yellow because it had been sprayed with some horrible systemic weed killer. They completely killed it dead and they'd gone yellow. I think it's the kind of weed killer that goes down to the roots and kills it at the root and the whole thing just turns. And I suddenly thought, this is beautiful, because it was beautiful, but I can't trust it. That's what I felt. I cannot trust this beauty, necessarily. Because it's kind of caused by the weed killer, in that particular case. And I've been slightly mistrustful of beauty ever since. I mean, beauty is wonderful, but, you've got to kind of look at it with a little bit of a critical eye, just in case it's caused by weed killer. Something else I remember reading is when you get a volcanic eruption, the sunsets get much more beautiful. So I think pollution and beautiful sunsets are kind of connected. So a beautiful sunset is your classic experience of beauty. Fantastic. But what if it's caused by pollution? What about that? I mean, volcanoes are natural enough, but plenty of pollution is not. So again, I think behind the simple awareness is some kind of knowledge. What is going on? Why is that sunset so red tonight? And that's a kind of different kind of awareness or different kind of knowledge. I think we especially need to add today to our perceptions. And I'll give you, one more example. I imagine a lot of us drove here today. Out of interest, how many people drove to the festival? Most people, yeah, sure. So I came across a billboard recently, one of those billboards advertising new cars. I can't remember what kind of car it was. But they'd chosen to highlight the fact this car only emitted 150 grams of CO2 per kilometre. There it was on the billboard. And this was meant to be good. And I kind of thought, well, great, that's probably less than all the other cars, otherwise they wouldn't be advertising it. But I just wonder, who knows what 150 grams of CO2 per kilometre means? So put your hand up if you kind of have a feeling for that. No one's put their hand up, yeah. Another little example, well, actually I'll go on with this one. So I saw this anyway, and I kind of got curious. I thought, well, what does 150 grams of CO2 per kilometre mean? And I went on the internet, and I discovered in normal air, like we've got here, there's 0.648 grams of CO2 per cubic metre of air. That's just a figure. But then you can start playing with the figure. 0.648 grams of CO2 per cubic metre of air. 1 gram of CO2 is about 1.5 meters cubic of air. This 150 grams of CO2 per kilometre of this car would be, don't do the maths, it's about 200 cubic metres of air anyway. So, but anyway, cut a long story short, I kind of calculated behind your car, as you drive along, you can visualize a snake. And this snake is your exhaust gases. And the exhaust gases are full of all sorts of horrible stuff, including carbon dioxide. And it's got the regular carbon dioxide from natural air in it, plus the extra you've emitted, which they've highlighted in this advert, making double the normal concentration of CO2. And double the normal concentration of CO2 is quite enough to completely mess up our planet and all life as we know it. So imagine a snake behind your car as you drive along, roughly the diameter of a dustbin lid. You know, a couple of feet diameter. And for every mile you drive, this snake gets a mile longer. You drive 100 miles, you've got a 100-mile snake behind you of double concentration carbon dioxide air. Quite enough to kill civilization as we know it. And imagine every mile you've driven in your car, ever since, you know, you've been driving, has got that snake behind it. And then I thought, well, how long does this carbon dioxide stick around? And the short answer is it sticks around forever, because it's been dug up from underneath planet Earth as a fossil fuel where it's been for years, and liberated into the atmosphere, and there it is. So this snake of double concentration carbon dioxide kind of sticks around forever. And even if you try and do something like plant trees to absorb it, it takes the trees 100 years to absorb that amount of carbon dioxide, so your snake kind of exists there for 100 years. And then I thought, well, imagine all the people driving up and down all the roads, and behind every car is this kind of snake of carbon dioxide sticking around for 100 years. It's kind of not surprising that the air is getting full up with double concentration CO2 that's going to change the climate. But that kind of awareness comes almost completely from science. You can't perceive it. It's invisible. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. You can't see it. You just have to learn it. But I think in our civilization, that kind of awareness is crucial. So behind beauty and behind simple sense perception, we just need the extra awareness of education, which I think is something Western society, Western science is particularly good at providing. So, I want to kind of start concluding now. I'll give you another little example. If I came across a packet of crisps recently, and they were Walker's crisps, I think, very big brand. And to their credit, they'd printed in small print down the bottom, under the ingredients, the carbon footprint of their packet of crisps. And the packet of crisps was 15 grams of crisps, but 68 grams of CO2. And once again, just a figure, who knows what that looks like, but you can calculate it as a living room full of double concentration CO2 that's going to wreck the planet and stick around 100 years. So one little bag of crisps implies a living room full of CO2 forever. Quite a thought. And I've carried on eating crisps. I'd be untrue to say I hadn't, but feeling more awkward about it. And it's not only crisps. It's not only crisps. Behind your apple from New Zealand, I think it's a great deal more, actually. So this leaves us with quite a dilemma, I think, and this is what I want to kind of conclude with. You can start becoming aware of all this stuff and start becoming kind of paralyzed, a bit like I was in the middle of that field full of spring flowers. You suddenly realize, oh my God, what am I doing? What have I done? I've been stomping over flowers all my life. I've been emitting living room fulls of CO2 and snakes of carbon dioxide. You know, what do I do? And I think the truth is there's no easy answers. There isn't an easy answer. I think linked with this awareness, which is true and valid, has to be a kind of kindness, a kind of sympathy to us and the dilemma we find ourselves in. And a lot of Buddhist teaching is about a growth in awareness and a growth in compassion, kindness, partly to ourselves and partly to planet Earth. And then I think all you can do is ask yourself more and more intensely, how do I want to live? I don't think it does any good beating yourself over the head. I think it does even less good beating other people over the head. But what you can ask is people grow in awareness and grow in kindness and ask that question, how do I want to live? And then I think for most people, I'm sure for most of us, your life starts to change quite naturally, quite organically. You just don't want to do the same old things anymore. And you just do want to kind of be more sensitive, be more intelligent, be more skilled. And just travel through the world with less of a footprint, more like the Buddha. Entering the forest, he moves not the grass. Entering the water, he makes not a ripple. And for me, that's a very beautiful way to live. And it's not possible to do it perfectly. You'd be talking about non-existence, really, rubbing yourself out. And that's not a solution. But it's possible to do it more and more, you know, more and more. And that's all we can really ask. So I'll just finish with another verse or two from the Dhamma, from the Zenren. And some of it is very paradoxical, because I think this leads you into the realm of kind of being stuck. You can't go forwards and you can't go backwards. You're going to make a mess whatever you do. So what do you do? So a lot of that is about that paradox. And here's a verse about it. It says, perceiving the sun in the midst of the rain, ladling out clear water from the depths of the fire. So maybe that says something about our situation. Perceiving the sun in the midst of the rain, ladling out clear water from the depths of the fire. Oh, thank you. The end.